From NPR and Chicago Public Radio, this is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. I'm Colonel Castle, and here's your host at the Chase Auditorium in downtown Chicago, Peter Sagal.
Thank you. Thank you, everybody. Oh, thank you. We got a great show for you today. Frank Rich, the columnist for the New York Times. He'll be here joining us later to play Not My Job. But first, I have to confess to you, we almost didn't have a show for you this week. Carl disappeared. Right after last week's show, we couldn't find him for days. Carl, where were you?
I was hiking on the Appalachian Trail.
Really? Because we found your boots and your walking stick and your cool little Swiss hiking hat all at home.
All right. Did I say hiking? I went to the jungle, the deserty jungle.
Okay, that sounds reasonable. So let's get going. The number to call, 1-888-WAIT-WAIT. That's 1-888-924-8924. It's time to welcome our first listener contestant. Hi, you're on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Hi, Peter. This is Fred from Atlanta, Georgia.
Hey, Fred. How are things in Atlanta?
Steamy.
Steamy. But things are exciting near the airport, so we're told. People coming and going quite mysteriously. Yeah, it's an exciting time to be there. Fred, let me introduce you to our panel. First up, say hello to a writer for HBO's Real Time for Bill Maher, Mr. Adam Felber.
Hi, Adam.
Hi, Fred. How are you?
Next, say hello to one of the women behind the Washington Post's reliable source column is Roxanne Roberts.
Hello, Roxanne.
Hello.
And it's the author and humorist who will host the Queen City Radio Hour on July 2nd at the Flynn Theater in Burlington, Vermont, Mr. Tom Baudet.
Hi, Fred.
Fred, welcome to our show. Now, you're going to start us off with Who's Carl This Time. Carl Castle, right here, is going to read you three quotes from the week's news. If you can correctly identify or explain just two of them, you will win our prize, Carl Castle's voice, on your home answering machine. You ready to go?
I'm ready.
All right. For your first quote, here's someone explaining why he decided to step out of the office for a spell.
I wanted to do something exotic.
That was somebody giving his first and maybe ultimately his best explanation for how he happened to vanish for 5 days. Who was it?
South Carolina Governor Mark Sanford.
That would be the guy. Henceforth, let it be known that I'm hiking the Appalachian Trail will be a euphemism to mean... I've ditched my security detail, not even told my wife and four kids where I'm going, and instead flew to Buenos Aires to canoodle with a Latina temptress.
Governor, the Argentinian trail, as
the
it were.
Yeah, as it were. Governor Sanford of South Carolina joins the growing army of social conservatives who decided to get a jump on destroying their own marriage before same-sex couples could do it to them. Disappearing for 5 days, during which his staff assured the press that he had gone for a hike on, as it turns out, and this is true, National Nude Hiking Day. Came back, Sanford gave a teary press conference in which he apologized to his family, his friends, the people of South Carolina, and all the nude hikers who were disappointed he never showed up.
Was this the best confessional speech ever?
Well, it's the best thing that could ever happen to John Ensign, for sure.
Oh, yeah. Ensign sent him the ticket to Buenos Aires.
Yeah.
It is true, as you mentioned, John Ensign, most recently, there have been a lot of Republicans who have confessed various infidelities, David Vitter, and most Republicans have gathered around them, have protected them, but not this guy, not him. And I think it's because this difference with Governor Sanford is that Sanford had the temerity to turn to foreign labor.
Yeah.
I mean...
Outsourcing your mistress?
What do you mean this is a job an American won't do? Come on!
NAFTA.
My brother-in-law did that last summer, by the way.
Really?
He hiked the Appalachian Trail, did he?
Yeah. He was gone for months. I mean, months.
You know, I'll never, ever be able to hear that phrase again, ever. I'll never be able to take it seriously.
Wow. You know, I don't want to get married yet. I want to, you know, hike the Appalachian Trail for a while first. Yeah, he had a midlife crisis. He went out and hiked the Appalachian Trail.
Stepped out to hike the Appalachian Trail, never came back.
Yeah.
Back in the day, you could hike the Appalachian Trail in the backseat of your car.
Yeah.
You know, probably as we speak, there are hundreds of people slogging their way across the Appalachian Trail.
Right.
And they're never going to be able to brag about it.
No, from now on.
An accomplishment of a lifetime.
And they can't talk about it.
Up in smoke.
And to have the dignity of that activity taken away on Naked Hiking Day.
I know. Yeah. Fred, are you still there, or have you given up on us?
Absolutely.
All right, Fred. Here is your next quote.
Participation by Iranian diplomats would not be appropriate in light of the unjust actions that the president and I have condemned.
That's Secretary of State Hillary Clinton sternly uninviting Iranian diplomats from what events next week?
The G8 conference?
No. This was going to be a special thing. It was a celebration next week, and Iranian diplomats were going to be invited.
Oh, the independence thing.
Exactly. The July 4th barbecues at American embassies. The Obama administration had wanted to reach out to the Iranian regime, so they invited diplomats in foreign capitals to come to the local American embassy's 4th of July picnics, because nothing melts the hearts of repressive regimes more than grilled tubes of animal scraps, gallons of tasteless beer, and Toby Keith music. But then, after the recent unrest, the State Department rescinded the invite, all the better, really, because who can forget the last time the Iranians came to a U.S. embassy picnic. First they sang Death to America the Beautiful. And then there was an uncomfortable moment when the ambassador handed out some miniature American flags to wave, and the Iranians immediately set fire to them. And once they were caught red-handed making their own fireworks, which they had promised to only develop for energy purposes.
We let them develop sparklers.
We did. We encouraged them to. It's going to destabilize the region.
They ship them.
They do. All right, Fred, here is your last quote. It's actually a series of quotes about a big blockbuster movie out this weekend. First, from The Washington Post.
Simply despicable.
From Gawker.com.
Loud, obnoxious, and loud.
And Chicago's own Roger Ebert.
One of the three or four amusing moments involves a dog-like robot humping the leg of the heroine.
So what big summer sequel has the critics up in arms?
Transformers Revenge of the Fallen.
Oh, you even knew the subtitle. Very good. Fans of the Transformer line of toys from the 80s were worried, of course, that director Michael Bay, who is to movie making what Hurricane Katrina was to urban planning, wouldn't truly capture the subtleties in the relationship between the good Autobots and the evil Decepticons. What of Optimus Prime's conflicted feelings for Starscream? But not to worry, everything blows up quite well in the movie. As for the film, it's probably going to do fine. It's hard to imagine anybody saying, you know, I was interested in seeing a movie about cars that transform into robots and back into cars, but Manola Dargis in the New York Times didn't recommend it. So I think I'll go to the Godard retrospective instead. Carl, how did Fred do in our quiz?
Well, Fred wins our prize, Peter. That's because he had 3 correct answers.
Well done, Fred. Congratulations. Thanks so much for playing. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Right now, panel, time for you, as always, to answer some questions about this week's news. Adam, you've probably heard of therapy dogs, pets to comfort seniors or other people recovering from illness or injury. A Montana woman is trying out a new animal for therapeutic purposes. What animal?
A cicada.
No. But that... You only get sick once every 17 years, though.
It treats a 17-year itch, yeah.
No.
So she's trying out a new animal.
A new therapy animal.
Bullfrog.
No.
Llama.
Wait, I'm going to give him a hint because I think I know this.
Please,
I'm
go ahead,
not
Roxanne.
Sure. Large animal, if I have this correct?
No.
Oh, okay. Well,
no, I'll take a hint from Peter, then, who does know the answer.
They do a lot of good. The male ones are good for getting people up at sunrise.
Oh, chickens.
Yes, therapy chickens. Yeah. Well, imagine you've been through a lot.
In defense of Roxanne, they're largish.
That's not what Roxanne was thinking of.
No, oh. I wasn't.
No.
What are they therapy for?
Well, you know, they're therapy, and you know, people who are recovering from illness or elderly.
You just want something around that's like dumber than you are?
Pretty much.
or this could be therapy for people who sleep in, have a hard time waking up at night.
Sure.
Yeah.
Let's say you're a week after surgery. You feel estranged from your friends and family. You wake up one morning in your hospital bed from your codeine-enhanced sleep and...
Broca!
A chicken there to show you you're not alone. Someone who understands what it's like to be afraid and nearly mindless. Someone who, if unable to comfort you spiritually or emotionally, is also delicious in the form of a nugget.
So if you traveled with them, would they wear those little jackets, the little red working chicken jackets?
Poultry therapist Jana Claremont says they're great because many seniors grew up on farms, she says, so holding chickens brings back fond memories of holding chickens. But they're also very useful in many different therapeutic situations. They can teach a patient, for example, who's been decapitated, that you can still run around for a while.
And that's comforting.
Yes.
And I also understand if you boil them up with some vegetables, they help with flu. And
exactly. Thank you, Carl. Thanks, everybody. Right now, it is time for the Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me Bluff the Listener game. Call 1-888-WAIT-WAIT to play our game on the air. Hi, you're on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Hi, this is Aruna in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
Hey, how are things in Minneapolis, my old home?
Oh, it is hot and humid.
Right, I understand. In Minneapolis, the weather is miserable for half the year, and then it's miserable in a whole new way.
Sums it up well.
Yeah, well, welcome to the show, Aruna.
Thank you.
You're going to play our game in which you must try to tell truth from fiction. Carl, what is Aruna's topic?
Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on?
Labor unions, suffering under years of diminishing membership and having their leaders buried under football fields. They're making a comeback, just what you'd expect under our new socialist regime. Each of our panelists are going to tell you a story of workers banding together. It may be well-meaning. It may not work out, though. Choose the real story. You'll win Carl's voice on your home answering machine. Ready to play, Aruna?
Sure am.
All right, first, let's hear from Roxanne Roberts.
They're mad as hell and not going to take it anymore. So Wall Street's masters of the universe are trying to form a union. Former Lehman Brothers analyst Bernie Heim is sick of being lumped in with the crooks, schemers, and brokers who caused the economic collapse. So he's calling all his former colleagues and urging them to join a new union, affectionately dubbed the No Bull Shirts. Quote, most of us are honest working stiff who used to get $4 million bonuses, Heim told the Wall Street Journal. A union will reassure the public that we deserve their trust, and with all the TARP money flowing in, allow a collective bargaining to protect our interests. The Bulls' first meeting was held last month. Only 11 unemployed stockbrokers actually showed up, but Heim is not discouraged. Everybody got a Don't Blame Me t-shirt and mug.
A union for Wall Street financiers. Your next story of an attempt at organizing comes from Adam Felber.
When it comes to labor issues, New England is no stranger to the concept of a bunch of workers banding together, but this may be the first time the workers have actually been banded. As in, they're pigeons. Yes, a bill has been filed in Massachusetts entitled, quote, An Act Relative to Pigeons in Motion Pictures, and it's the brainchild of professional pigeon wrangler Bill Damaris, who has had it up to his ankles with scruffy, undocumented amateur birds coming up from God knows where, willing to work for breadcrumbs, taking the jobs of clean, honest, hard-working avian thespians. Damaris got the idea while deploying his pigeon prodigies on the set of the new movie Telltale Heart, which was shooting in Rhode Island. To Damaris' shock, the producers were supplementing his flock with a bunch of wild, undocumented birds brought up from New York. Yes, some rat without wings was bringing in scabs with wings. Quote, if you have something really nice, you don't want someone bringing in something really awful and destroying it. If Damaris has his way, local jobs will be safe, even if local statues won't.
A union for pigeons in Massachusetts. Your last story of people looking for that union label comes from Tom Baudet.
After 20 years of freelance work as an informant and hired muscle for various union-busting law firms, Peter C. Quigley has had enough. We get the short end of every stick we ain't actually swinging, said Quigley. They put us in flea-bag motels for months at a time. We get spit on. Our cars get burned. Dating? Forget about it. And these ain't the top-shelf law firms we're dealing with here. A lot of the time, we don't get paid. So what's an exploited professional union-busting goon to do? Organize. The Brotherhood of Benevolent Busters has filed with the National Labor Relations Board in a move to protect their membership from the very practices they work daily to promote. It's what you call ironical, Quigley admitted. But I ask you this, who are they going to hire to stop us?
So one of these groups, Aruna, is trying to organize. Is it from Roxanne Roberts, Wall Street Banksters? From Adam Felber, Pigeons in the Motion Picture Industry? Or from Tom Baudet, Union Busters? Which of these is the real story of an attempt at collectivization?
Wow. I think I'm going to go with the third. I'm going to go with Tom's description.
You're going to go with Tom's story, the Union Busters unionizing. Because as I say, who's going to stop them? That's your choice?
Right.
All right. Well, we spoke to somebody who's familiar with this remarkable effort to collectivize labor.
It's almost like unionizing pigeons. He wants to have only pigeons that are licensed and banded in Massachusetts to be able to appear as extras in films made in Massachusetts.
That was Laurel Sweet, who's a reporter for the Boston Herald, talking about the effort to unionize Massachusetts movie pigeons. I'm sorry, as you have figured out, it was Adam who had the true story. You did not win our game, but you earned a point for Tom's rather revolutionary idea.
And I thank you, Aruna.
Anyway, thanks so much for playing, Aruna.
Thank you for having me.
Bye-bye.
Now, you want higher wages, let me tell you what to do. Got to talk to the workers in the shop with you. You got to build you a union, got to make it strong. But if you all stick together, boys, won't be long. You got shorter hours. Better working conditions.
And now the game where we do what we can to remind knowledgeable people that, no, in fact, they don't know everything. The name of our guest used to strike terror into the hearts of certain people, namely actors, writers, directors, and financial backers of Broadway shows in the 1980s and early 90s. As the chief theater critic for the New York Times, he was known as the Butcher of Broadway. These days, though, as the weekly op-ed columnist for the New York Times, he tries to strike terror into politicians and pundits and other assorted targets. Frank Rich, welcome to Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. So if you don't mind, let's start right in on the Butcher of Broadway thing, because I was in the theater in the 1980s, and you were much feared. People thought that you were just viciously destroying things left and right. Did you enjoy doing that?
It's overstated, and no, although, you know, if I had been able to put a dent in Cats, maybe I would have been happy.
You tried, though, didn't you?
I tried, but I did not succeed.
No. Your negative reviews, such as they were legendary. For example, I think your review of the play Moose Murders became more well-known than the play itself.
Well, the play itself is virtually unknown because it literally closed on opening night. And it was a play that even 20 years later is unforgettable. It was a murder mystery where it turned out the murderer was a quadriplegic. It became a legendary failure, and what happened was that everyone in New York claimed to have seen it on that one performance.
Right.
Even though it was in a 1,000-seat theater.
It would have had to be in Yankee Stadium.
Exactly.
Your bad reviews, when they came, were great bad reviews. I mean, did you enjoy, on those occasions when you wrote a negative review, was it more fun than writing a positive review?
No, there was nothing more exhilarating than to really to write a favorable review of something that you really felt passionately about, you know, a Sunday in the Park with George or an Angels in America. Bad reviews, particularly of really good artists, are, you know, sorrowful and difficult to write.
Yeah.
However, there's a small category of play where you can just write jokes because it's not even in contention. And weirdly, when I was doing in this job, they all seem to begin with M. There was Moose Murders, there was a Marlowe, a musical about Christopher Marlowe, the playwright.
Oh, God.
Ian Shakespeare smoked dope backstage. There was a musical called Merlin about the it was ridiculous. Oh. There were at least two musicals called Marilyn about Marilyn Monroe, one of which had Arthur Miller as a song and dance man.
Sure. Were you ever one of those guys who you hear about who reviewed it because you tried to do it and couldn't? Were you ever a playwright or an actor yourself?
Except in the earliest days, like in junior high school, no. I really fell in love. I was in love with the theater, but I really fell in love with the journalism early on.
Right.
And so, no. I w- such critics do exist, and more embarrassingly, some of them actually, once they became critics, taken furloughs to try to direct or act or write plays, and it's almost always excruciating.
It's not a good thing. It's not a good thing. When you showed up, because you were pretty feared, the New York Times in general and you in particular were seen as having a lot of power, fairly
sure.
or not. When you showed up, did people's behavior change? Were people scared of you? Did they suck up to you? What was it like?
Well, what was crazy was everyone was trained, no matter what the show, to scream and yell and cheer. And it could be the worst thing in the history of the world, and people would be falling out of their seats.
So did they ever plan people next to you to weep and turn to you and say, this has changed my life?
Oh, all the time, and it's so transparent, and people would be saying, having these ostentatiously loud conversations like, oh my God, you know, not since Long Day's Journey into Night have I liked to play, you know, as much as Get Gertie's Garter or whatever it was.
Let me ask you, though, about your current gig. You've been writing an op-ed column for the Sunday Times now for many years.
Yeah.
Could you sum it up, what your take is? I mean, do you have a particular angle that you could say what it is? You write about politics mainly, pop culture as it affects politics.
I've always, you know, I grew up in Washington, D.C., as a kid in love with the theater, and I think my entire career, including really as a theater critic to some extent, has been to try to find the intersection of culture and the news, or culture and politics. And so while it's not something I follow rigidly, it is my sensibility and my inclination, and I like to refract the real world through the fake world and vice versa, and it's fun for me.
Right. I've noticed, and forgive me for saying this, that certainly over the last decade or 8 years or so, you've been rather harsh in your criticisms of certain people on certain sides of the political spectrum.
Right.
You've been fairly negative.
Yes.
Are you enjoying yourself?
Well, I have to say that's different from the theater. You know, I frankly have, you know, if it's upsetting to write a negative review of, say, a great artist that has a failure, I can't say that I was crying in my sleep about criticizing Dick Cheney.
Right.
And let's face it, more is at stake in a war in Iraq than in moose murders, I think.
That's probably true.
Yeah.
I don't know if moose murders actually killed anybody.
No, just the audience.
Exactly. Now, we're going to try something with you. We haven't tried this before, but like I said, we've noted again that you're known for your harsh opinions, particularly the last few years. So what we're going to do is we're going to bring out the kinder, gentler Frank Rich. We're going to ask you right now, just a little exercise before we get to the game. We're going to ask you to name some people in the news, and we want you to say something nice about them.
Go ahead.
Here we go. Ready? Mark Sanford, governor of South Carolina.
Brilliant stand-up comic.
There you go. Good. Alaska Governor Sarah Palin.
I can't use the same joke twice. A great argument for the virtues of Hawaii.
All right. Bill O'Reilly? Yes.
He makes Glenn Beck makes him look sane.
There you are. Voldemort.
Not the Phantom of the Opera.
There you go. Well done, Frank Rich. Congratulations. You see, the softer side of Frank Rich. Frank Rich, in fact, we have asked you here to play a game we're calling...
Now this is a butcher.
They used to call you the Butcher of Broadway. Unfair, we know, so we thought we'd ask you about a genuine butcher. In fact, the man called the most famous butcher in the world, Dario Cecchini of Tuscany, Italy, answered two questions about Signor Cecchini correctly. You win our prize for one of our listeners, Carl Castle's voice on their home answering machine. Carl, who is Frank Rich playing for?
Peter, Frank is playing for Peggy Echt and Matt Price of Atlanta, Georgia.
All right. Here's your first question. Though he came from a long line of butchers going back centuries, Dario Cecchini vowed to become the first Cecchini in three centuries to do something else with his life. Instead, so, he trained to be A, pastry chef, B, a veterinarian, or C, an animal rights activist.
Boy, that's interesting. Animal rights activist.
No, actually, it was veterinarian. Yeah. Wanted to be a veterinarian. He studied it until his father, on his deathbed, apologized for not teaching him the fine art of butchery. Dario immediately left veterinary school and found a different way to cure animals.
What a great story. I love it.
It's
I
true.
Love it.
Don't blame me. He did it. All right. Now, the most famous Tuscan beef dish is bistecca fiorentina, a thick steak famed in that region. But according to author Bill Buford, who spent 6 months training with Cecchini, on one occasion the master butcher refused to serve bistecca fiorentinas. Why? A, he felt the customers that day did not deserve them. B, he had decided that the steak was, quote, fascistic in its brutality. Or C, the customers asked for a bottle of A1 steak sauce with it.
I vote for the third.
You're going to go for the A1 steak sauce?
Yes.
He was offended?
Yes.
No, it was A. He just felt they didn't deserve them. Buford writes, quote...
Are you sure he's not French?
No, no. He's moody. He's Italian. Quote, says Buford, on my first morning, three requests were refused for no reason I could understand, except in Dario's eyes, the customers had not been deserving. All right. Last question here. At the restaurant next to his butcher shop in Tuscany, the restaurant is called Only Meat. Cecchini doesn't serve steaks, but he does serve what? A, boiled beef knees with salsa verde. B, pig esophagus with kale and garlic. Or C, braised sheep lips with singed elk hair.
I would go for B.
B, you're going to go for pig esophagus with kale and garlic?
Yes.
Sounds good. Sounds like
especially
trafe.
Mitch Law.
Yes, I know. I was about to say it sounds trafe, but it sounds good. No, it was A, boiled beef knees. Boiled beef knees, specialty of the house there. Yeah. Mm. Carl, how did Frank Rich do in our quiz?
Not too well, Peter. No correct answers, and he had to have at least two correct answers to win for Peggy and Matt.
I think we should do this as in a Frank Rich style. Like, Frank Rich is a complete failure at taking quizzes. Clearly, he has no, I'm sorry. That's cool. You see, you seem to handle it well, though.
I tried.
You've been in the trenches, and you can take it. Frank Rich is an award-winning op-ed columnist for the New York Times. Frank Rich, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Yeah.
Thanks for being here.
Over meat and old potatoes just ain't right like green tomatoes. Here I'm waiting, palpitating with all that meat and old potatoes.
Now, every week a new story comes along about a certain world leader who seems to be trying to get himself onto our show. Who are we to say no? So this week we are introducing a new game we're calling...
The answer is always Silvio Berlusconi.
So, Roxanne, here we go. Please listen to Carl.
I've never paid a woman. I've never understood where the satisfaction is when you're missing the pleasure of conquest.
Who said that?
Could it be Berlusconi?
Yes, it is. Silvio Berlusconi.
Nice.
This week's Berlusconi scandal. A woman has claimed she was paid by one of Berlusconi's rivals to spend the night with him. Berlusconi says she is lying, but she released a recording, which she made surreptitiously, in which Berlusconi is heard to say, quote, go and wait for me in the big bed, unquote, because that is Silvio Berlusconi for you, ladies and gentlemen. He does like that challenge. For example, the challenge of finding his latest paramour somewhere on the big bed.
Hiking the Florentine Trail, as it were.
As it were. Right now, panel, some more questions for you from the week's news. Adam, a scandal in New York City. According to the New York Post, a chaplain has been fired, and there are multiple investigations going on trying to figure out who exactly approved what being allowed in a city jail.
Companion chicken.
No.
An exorcism.
No. It was a religious ceremony of a kind, but not that.
In a prison.
Yes.
A wedding.
Close.
A gay wedding?
No.
Another
big family event.
Oh, bar mitzvah.
A bar mitzvah! Today I am a felon. Tuvia Stern is a father first, and a financial scam artist serving 2.5 years for first-degree grand larceny, second. The Post reported that Stern somehow convinced officials at the Manhattan prison where he is serving time to ease up its prison-like rules for an extravagant bar mitzvah for his son. Prison authorities agreed. 60 guests attended. A live band performed. There was dancing in the prison gym. There was a kosher meal served. We should note forks were allowed at the dinner, but caterers were forced to fashion knives out of toothbrushes for guests to cut their meat. And they even provided special butter shivs for the dinner rolls. Everyone had a blast. The boys got their own prison tats. In fact, the party went on so long, several of the boys converted to Islam.
Imagine unwrapping those presents. Oh, cigarettes, how thoughtful. Oh, cigarettes, you shouldn't have. What's this, cigarettes?
Tom, next week, presidency of the European Union passes from the Czech Republic to Sweden. The handover actually began last weekend when officials from each country met in Prague and handed over what?
Czech Prime Minister's missing swimming suit.
No.
The Stanley Cup.
No. Sadly, Sweden did not bring a tap.
A keg of beer.
A keg of beer.
Nice.
They passed it between two boats. Rejecting the traditional EU chest bump and bro hug, the Czechs borrowed the ancient handover of leadership ceremony from the Greek week at Ohio State. The Czech Minister for European Affairs said they were looking for a symbol of the Czech presidency to hand to the Swedes, and quote, "We ended up with a keg of beer," unquote. Next, Sweden plans to pass on the presidency with a local symbol of their country. They will give the next country a trendy-looking but flimsy dining table. with, of course, an Allen wrench and wordless instructions. Incidentally, Sweden is transferring power to France, which in their own ancient custom will hold on to the presidency for 8 minutes, flinch, and give it to Germany.
Too soon!
Adam, the Obama administration promised to be much more transparent than the secretive Bush administration, but so far nothing has changed much. In fact, last week, Obama Justice Department lawyers argued that they would not release records concerning former Vice President Dick Cheney because what nefarious enemy might make use of them?
Congress.
No. Call it the Axis of Mockery.
Comedians?
Yes, late night comics. At issue, and this
That's
is
a strong legal argument.
Isn't
right
it,
there.
Though?
Yeah.
At issue are the records of the FBI's interview with Dick Cheney about the Valerie Plame investigation. Remember that? In open court, a Justice Department lawyer fighting a lawsuit demanding the release of these records said, quote, "I don't want a future vice president to say, I'm not going to cooperate with you because I don't want to be fodder for The Daily Show," unquote. Now, we at Wait Wait were lucky enough to get a peek at the transcripts of Dick Cheney's testimony, and it turns out maybe the Obama administration was right to cover this stuff up. I'll now read from it. Well, let me tell you, waterboarding these guys was tough. I mean, it was hard.
How hard was it?
I'm telling you. It was torture. Little tribute to Ed McMahon, ladies and gentlemen. Coming up, it's lightning fill in the blank, but first it's the game where you have to listen for the rhyme. If you'd like to play on air, call or leave a message at 1-888-WAIT-WAIT. That's 1-888-924-8924. You can send an email to waitwait@npr.org. You can also go to our website at waitwait.npr.org, where you can find out about attending our weekly live shows right here at the Chase Auditorium in Chicago, or you can download the Wait Wait podcast for your computer or MP3 player if you're curious about the secret lives of radio personalities, then check us out on Twitter, twitter.com/waitwait. Hi, you're on Wait Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Hi, this is Leslie from Mount Lebanon, Pennsylvania.
Hey, Leslie, how are you?
I'm great, thanks. How are you?
I'm fine. Well, what do you do there in Mount Lebanon?
I'm a mostly stay-at-home mom.
Mostly?
Mostly.
Except for when they let you out.
Yeah, every once in a while they set me free.
They set you free, like little furloughs.
Yes.
What do you do? Do you run around and misbehave?
I do. I wreak all kinds of havoc, but no one knows it's me, so
I won't tell anyone.
Thank you.
Leslie, welcome to the show. Carl Castle, of course, is going to read you three news-related limericks with the last word or phrase missing from each. If you can fill in that last word or phrase correctly in two of the limericks, you will be a winner. Ready to play?
I'm ready.
Here is your first limerick.
The moon looks serene and so calm. Let us blast all that lunar aplomb. The effect's not as big if we just start to dig. So let's get down inside with a...
bomb?
Right, a bomb.
Yay.
Who among us hasn't sat outside on a clear summer evening, gazed up at the moon, and thought, man, I want to blow that to lunar kibble? Well, NASA feels the same way. They're now planning to fire a Centaur rocket armed with explosives into the surface of the moon, not just for the cool explosion, but to determine whether any traces of water or vapor will be revealed. The bombing is the first step toward planning lunar colonies, because why wait until we've settled there to start blowing things up? Also, according to long-standing U.S. government policy, blowing it up is the first step toward turning it into a democracy. Here is your next limerick.
My plants say, don't talk to us, bro. Your deep voice makes our progress slow. We will strike root with a voice that sounds cute. Bring a girl here to help us to...
grow.
Right. Put down that trowel, Barry White. If you want to make your plants grow faster, you need a woman's voice. That's the report from the Royal Horticultural Society in Britain. Scientists played recordings of various voices to 10 tomato plants for 2 months. They found the plants that listened to female voices grew over an inch more than those that listened to male voices. And in some cases, the male voices were so bad, the plants grew less than plants that nobody talked to. Women all over the country right now are listening to this and going, oh yeah. One woman in the study said, quote, I think it's an honor to have a voice that can make tomatoes grow. The scientists warned the method is not foolproof, however, citing a tragic afternoon when an episode of The View wiped out an entire crop.
This explains a lifelong phenomenon that
what?
I've noticed, that plants get sick when I take care of them.
It's your voice.
Yeah.
Plus you water them with beer.
I can't speak to this. I have managed to kill virtually every plant that has found its way into my environment.
You're not talking to them, that's why.
No, is that it?
I think so.
It
might help. I've gotten taller in the last few minutes, so. Here is your last limerick.
As grass by the cartloads I slurp, my four stomachs do not squeak or chirp. I'm a new breed of cattle. Against methane I battle. I produce less gas, and I don't...
oh, my boys are going to love this one. Burp.
Yes! Everyone loves cows. They're cute, they're tasty, but at the same time, no one would want to be stuck in an elevator with one of them. Canadian researchers, though, have come up with a solution to the burpy cow problem. They've used genetic studies to create cows that produce 25% less methane gas. These new burpless cows are also much more polite than their belching counterparts. They always remember to cover their mouths and say, excuse me. But as pleasant as they are to be around, the new cows are plagued with problems. Large numbers of burpless cows have been seen swelling up and simply floating away.
Yeah, they're a great invention, but on their fourth birthday, they tend to explode.
Carl, how did Leslie do in our quiz?
Leslie had 3 correct answers, and Leslie, I'll be doing the message on your home answering machine.
Well done. Congratulations, Leslie.
Thank you very much.
Now on to our final game, Lightning Fill-in-the-Blank. Each of our players now has 60 seconds in which to answer as many fill-in-the-blank questions as he or she can. Each correct answer now worth 2 points. Carl, can you give me the scores?
We have a tie for first place, Peter. Adam Felber and Tom Baudet each has 3 points. Roxanne Roberts has 2.
All right, Roxanne, you're in third place. You're up first. The clock will start when I begin your first question. Fill in the blank. A Tennessee hospital confirmed rumors that Apple founder blank had gotten a liver transplant there.
Steve Jobs.
Right. Investigators believe that a failure of the automated computer system may have led to the fatal metro crash in blank.
In Washington, D.C.
Right. After being held by the Taliban for 7 months, a reporter for the blank escaped unharmed.
The New York Times.
Right. President Nicolas Sarkozy announced that France is considering a ban on blanks because they are degrading to women.
Burkas.
Right. A Sam's Club in Maryland apologized for promoting its pharmacy by blanking.
By twittering.
No, by giving kids prescription pill bottles filled with candy. On their show Monday night, TLC's John and Kate announced that they were blanking.
They were splitting up.
They were getting divorced. This week, Simon & Schuster announced that they will be publishing the memoir of former Vice President blank.
Dick Cheney.
Yes, UK jewel thieves were busted after a heist when their getaway driver blanked.
When he forgot to bring the car.
When he refused to break the speed limit. The thieves had almost $120,000 worth of gems in their stolen Alfa Romeo, with squad cars and police helicopters hot on their trail. But a school zone is a school zone. Getaway driver Neil Murray conscientiously took his foot off the gas pedal every time they went through a slow zone, and they were caught. Carl, how did Roxanne do in our quiz?
Roxanne had 6 correct answers for 12 more points. She now has 14 points.
All right, very well done. Should we flip the coin? Adam has elected to go next. Here you go. Fill in the blank. International superstar and the king of pop, blank, died at the age of 50 on Thursday.
Michael Jackson.
Right. As tensions between the countries escalated, blank threatened to wipe out the U.S. once and for all.
North Korea.
Right. On Thursday, blank denied he had made threats to Bank of America.
Dick Cheney.
Ben Bernanke.
Oh.
After a long battle with cancer, Charlie's Angel star blank died at age 62.
Farrah Fawcett.
Right. Norwegian customs officials on a train were surprised when they discovered a blank had been checked as luggage.
Giant sea turtle.
Live alligator. Best known as Johnny Carson's sidekick for 30 years, blank died at age 86.
Ed McMahon.
Right. The Academy Awards announced it would be doubling the number of blanks at next year's Oscars.
Best picture.
Right. Best picture nominees. A new study from the University of Waterloo has found that making positive affirmations to boost your self-esteem actually blanks.
Lowers your self-esteem.
Exactly right. 68 people were asked to repeat positive phrases to themselves. I'm good enough. I'm smart enough. And I take orders from social scientists. Their self-esteem did not improve, and in some cases actually got worse. Psychologists now suggest that you tell yourself horrible things. I'm worthless, I'm a good for nothing, in the hope that since you believe yourself to be an idiot, you'll disagree.
Yeah, if I'm telling myself I'm great, I must be missing something.
Exactly. What would I know about me?
Yeah. That's when you need the chicken. Right there.
Yeah.
That's when you need the chicken could become another catchphrase. He was off hiking the Appalachian Trail, and that's when he needed the chicken. Carl, how did Adam do in our quiz?
Adam had 6 correct answers, 12 more points. He now has 15 points, and Adam has the lead.
Well done. All right. How many, then, does Tom need to take it from him?
6 to tie, 7 to win outright.
All right, here we go, Tom. This is for the game. The death of Nida Aga Sultan made her a symbol for the protesters in blank.
Iran.
Right. The Senate Finance Committee chairman announced Thursday that his committee had come up with a $1 trillion blank plan.
Healthcare plan.
Right. On Monday, President Obama signed tough new anti-blanking legislation.
Smoking.
Right. A U.S. diplomat was allowed to meet with 2 journalists imprisoned in blank this week.
North Korea.
Right. A company in Switzerland is advertising aerial tram tours by promising that tourists can see mountain goats, eagles, and even a few blank.
Nude hikers.
Right. After 3 weeks on the show, I'm a celebrity, get me out of here, the wife of blank was finally voted off.
What's his name? Blagojevich.
Right. Headline writers could not resist invoking Simon and Garfunkel in news stories about Kodak's plan to discontinue blank.
Kodachrome.
Kodachrome. Right. Officials in Australia say that mysterious crop circles spotted recently may be caused by blank.
Aliens.
No. Stoned wallabies. According to Tasmania's Attorney General, we have a problem with wallabies entering poppy fields, getting as high as a kite, and going around in circles. Then they crash. Unquote. The Tasmanian government immediately took action. They adopted a new resolution that severely restricts wallaby access to Cheech and Chong movies. Carl, did Tom do well enough to win?
Well, he needed at least 7 to win outright, and Tom had 7 correct.
Oh, my God.
Oh, boy. With 17 points,
what
Tom
a performance.
Is this week's champion.
What a performance.
Thank you.
Man, you sprinted the Appalachian Trail. You know what I mean? In just a minute, we're going to ask our panelists, now that hiking the Appalachian Trail has become such a famous phrase, we're going to ask them what the next big euphemism will be and what it will mean. But first, let me tell you all that support for NPR comes from NPR stations and CSX, working to reduce traffic and pollution while moving 750,000 tons of freight daily. CSX, how tomorrow moves. The Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. And Angie's List, providing consumer reviews on local professionals, from doctors and veterinarians to plumbers and roofers. Details at angieslist.com. Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me is a production of NPR and Chicago Public Radio. In association with Urgent Haircut Productions, Doug Berman, executive producer. Philip Gotica writes our limericks. Our house manager is Don Hall. Our intern is Bethany Williams. We welcome her this week. Our web guru is Beth Novi. Engineers include Les Dolarchik and Muhammad Mao. Thanks to John Zajac and Chase Bank. B.J. Lederman composed our theme. Our program is produced by Ian Chillog, Eva Walchover, and Emily Ecton. Technical direction from Robert Newhouse and Lorna White. The senior producer of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me is Mike Danforth. Now, panel, what will be the next big euphemism? Tom Baudet.
Sneaking off to Argentina will be what we say when we are planning to hike the Appalachian Trail.
Roxanne Roberts.
In a similar vein, flying to Buenos Aires will become the new euphemism for failed GOP presidential campaigns.
And Adam Felber.
Refusing to admit an affair, even when it was filmed, photographed, and recorded in stereo, will be known as blocking the Cheney memos.
Well, if we hear any of those euphemisms, panel, we'll ask you about it on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Thank you, Carl Castle. Thanks also to Tom Baudet, Roxanne Roberts, Adam Felber, our friend. So are you. You are our friends. Thank you for listening. I am Peter Sagal. We will see you next week. This is NPR, National Public Radio.